The Business on RTE Radio 1 with AIB. It takes a certain kind of brave to run a business. We see it, we back it.
Now, as we were talking there, the government is considering the introduction of all kinds of different dividends because of the tough months of restrictions that we've all had to endure. And it's been a hard time for a lot of people, physically and mentally. 27-year-old Amy Louise Carton was inspired to set up a business because of her mental health battles. The Keep Appy app is used in 130 countries worldwide. Not bad for a business that was dreamed up just 4 years ago. Unlike most mental health apps, it doesn't concentrate solely on meditation, but it looks at journaling, a gratitude diary, sleep monitoring, and mindfulness. Just to warn people that they might find some elements of this interview distressing, I caught up with Amy earlier and I first put it to her that many people have personal connections to their businesses, but this really is the case in her own story. I asked her to tell me what happened to prompt the startup of this business.
Absolutely. I almost think what happened was the trigger behind the company. I was never really interested in business before what happened, really. So the background really is my history with mental illness, my journey from being incredibly unwell and making a suicide attempt, an attempt on my life, all the way through the recovery, all the way through seeing what mental illness is at its worst, what recovery is at its heightened, most heightened point. It is true that this was a company that was driven by my darkest day, really.
What was that darkest day? What happened to you that changed so much for you?
Really, it began a few years ago when I reached breaking point, where I walked up onto the Dundrum Lewis Bridge, and after consuming a large amount of medication that I had found in my house that I had was used to manage my epilepsy and other illnesses, I decided to end my life. And yeah, it was an incredibly dark moment, and it had been months in the making where I had felt like there was no one I could turn to. There was no one I wanted to burden with my pain. And that was really the starting point. That was the point when, well, the ending point, I guess, as opposed to the starting point, because that's when I really thought it was time to end my life.
What brought you to that point?
So a few years previously, I had been sexually assaulted. And like so many victims of sexual assault, I couldn't face it. I didn't want to face it. I tried to move on. I tried to just get over it. You know, you're told time and time again in culture that why can't you just get over it? And the problem with sexual violence or sexual assault is it's not something you can really get over. And I tried to, and my body started lashing out against me. It had its physical manifestation of what the mental illness of PTSD was, and that created these non-epileptic attack seizures. So these are psychological seizures that are very similar to regular seizures. They seem, or neurological seizures, they seem just the same. And I was having over 30 a day. I was incredibly sick and bedbound and just incredibly unwell. And that was really it for me. I just couldn't see a way out of that.
Was that long after the assault? Was it obvious to you that what had happened to you before was a big part of the reason why you were unwell?
Gosh, no. It was 3 years later. I thought I had moved on. I think on the night I was attacked, a part of me died. And then the suicide attempt 3 years later was really just the final moment of that darkness that had been inside of me for so long that I hadn't been able to let out.
And while you were dealing with all that, you completed your studies,
yeah.
You were going to go to Brussels, you had a job lined up in Brussels. Tell me about that.
Really, in those 3 years, and it shows the testament of, you know, how powerful the mind is, how much you can block. It may not last forever, but you can really, really just break things up and manage things. But I had raised, you know, one of the largest funds for students, one of the largest student fundraising events during that time. I'd graduated both an undergrad and a master's degree. I was doing things left, right and centre that everyone would have seen as, oh, this girl is fine. This girl is doing well. She's achieving things. I had always wanted to work in the EU or an international organisation. And I was on track for that. Everything on paper was going perfectly.
So you find yourself in the midst of all that, on a bridge in Dundrum, and you've decided that's it. I want out. I want to end this. What happened?
Well, it's funny. When you're in that moment, there's nothing rational going through your mind. And it's something that's really hard to understand if you've never experienced suicidal ideation or been close to someone who's experienced it. Because when you're at that point, it is very irrational. That's the only way to describe it. So I decided to call a helpline, not with the intention of being saved. I really did not want to be saved. I just wanted my parents to see when they found my phone that I had tried, or to think that I had tried. And on the phone to the helpline volunteer, and even now I can hear her voice in my ear. It's so strange thinking back to it. But she asked me about my family and tried to reason with me and bring me through a journey of, you know, they'll miss you. And at that point, I was so unwell, I could only see myself as a burden. I thought I was a burden on my loved ones, that it would be better for them if I was gone. And then she brought up my dog. And my dog is the most sassy, you know, like crazy dog I know. But in that moment, all I could think about was that no one would spoil her like I would. No one would care for her or bring her on as many walks or love her as much as I loved her. And that's how I managed to literally crawl on my hands and knees home and get help and get all the medical attention I needed. And that's what began my journey to recovery.
So the helpline person was really trying to get through all of those
Absolutely.
Emotions and all that irrationality, maybe, as you say, that you were feeling. And the point that got through was about your dog.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's incredible. It's such incredibly unexpected things that hold us to reality. And that's extraordinary, that even at our darkest moments, we as people have this caring, this pure need to love others, to care for others inside of us.
So after that day, I'm sure beginning to come back from that point was probably a very long journey and a difficult journey. But how did things change for you after that?
I wish I could say there was a magic bullet. I wish I could say that I, in that moment, had this desire to live again. But that's not really how it worked. It was quite a slow-moving recovery. And I'm such a hard worker is the wrong word, but I'm always a teacher's pet, really. So when my psychiatrist and psychologist suggested I do workbooks or worksheets to try explore what I was feeling and everything that was going on, I printed nearly every worksheet I could find off the internet, did them all and brought them in a folder to my psychologist to kind of turn around and say, here, I have it all ready to go. I'm cured. Can I have my gold star on my ability to leave? Can I leave now and say that I'm cured? But that's obviously not how therapy and recovery works. So over the course of really, it was an 8-month long recovery journey. It was incredibly long. I didn't really ever learn the love to live. I still struggle with moments of suicidal ideation. I still struggle with that darkness inside of me that sometimes takes over. But I learned to accept, and this is the most important thing, particularly around PTSD, that these things have happened and that's okay. And it's learning how to live with them instead of pretending they would never happened.
So you decided you wanted to do something about this for
Yes.
other people. And you looked at what was out there and what kind of help people could get. And obviously one very effective avenue is online and Mm. apps and all of that. So how did Keep Appy come about then?
Really began during the recovery process with me filling out those worksheets, trying to speed up the recovery process. I wanted to be cured as quick as possible to get back to my life, to get back on track. And part of that was me turning to my doctors and saying, what can I do to speed this up? I see you, you know, every day during the working hours, but what if I can do more after hours? And I was like, I see all these meditation apps on my social media feed. I'll just download one of them and it'll cure me. They very quickly turned around and told me that I was not a suitable candidate for a mobile phone meditation platform. That in fact, because of my personality disorder and my PTSD, which are both stress-driven, being alone in an unsafe environment or even just in my bedroom, it wouldn't be the right way to learn how to meditate. And there were so many things that I could just see were wrong with the industry and wrong with the apps available that I just, without really thinking about it, decided to start doing it myself.
So you have the idea. Mm-hmm. You know what you want to achieve with it. What do you do then? How do you progress it?
Yeah, going from zero to one in a startup world is incredibly tough. But I basically talked to anyone and everyone who would listen to me. I got stuck into the startup ecosystem. I had no idea what I was doing. And that's really where I began. It was just me on my computer desk in my bedroom, just building out prototypes, trying to figure out what would work and how it would look, and then just testing it out on as many people.
And one of the best things that you can do, or anyone can do starting a business, is to get somebody to join up with you early on who can do some of the things that you can't do. So what did you do there?
Yeah, so I was incredibly lucky having people join my team. I went to Trinity College. I did a master's in business because I had no background in business. And I met this guy there because we kept getting put on the same teams for different projects, for different essays and collaborations together. I think it was because our names were synced alphabetically. And I thought he was the biggest jock going. He played rugby for Trinity. He was American. He was from Kansas. And I just saw the worst in him. And he saw the worst in me. He thought I was a social justice warrior and a hippie. Like, all I would do was talk about mental health and the crisis we were facing. And neither of us liked each other, but we kept ending up partnered.
Did you tell him?
Oh, yeah. And we talk about it since. We basically realized that we were co-workers before we were friends. But somewhere along the journey of that year, I kept harping on nonstop about mental health. And eventually it came out that he felt safe enough to discuss it, that his uncle had died by suicide. And he had always believed his uncle didn't exercise enough. That was kind of what he felt. He didn't take care of himself physically, and that led to the mental illness. And I think it was because working together, we explored, like we talked about it, we were open about it. I was constantly talking about mental health, that he really came to terms with what was a really serious family tragedy that he was never really allowed to talk about just due to the stigma. So he then really got sucked into our mission, to make mental health care accessible and available.
You've talked about the difficulties and the challenges that you've faced in your life and very dark days and how far you've come from that. How are you now? You know, you talked about personality disorder. Is that something that still affects you? Is it something that is still a battle that you have to deal with?
Absolutely. So both PTSD and borderline personality disorder are both lifelong illnesses. I will never be free of them. So there are times when I really struggle, such as when the anniversary of my attack comes up, or if I don't take care of myself properly. You know, our mental health and physical health are very intertwined. So being able to balance the two is very important for someone like me with a personality disorder. So it is a constant battle, and I do have ups and downs, but it's learning to manage that and accept that that's a part of my life and to work around it.
Is running this business a big help? I'd imagine it is. And then at times you've a particularly stressful day, you've a bad day, you maybe get a few knockbacks, as anybody will in business. And then is that harder then?
Absolutely. Oh my gosh, can you imagine? And the thing about personality disorder is we don't tolerate people with this disorder, do not tolerate rejection, well, at all. So if I get any sense of rejection, I feel the floor fall out from under me. I really struggle. But on the flip side, with borderline personality disorder, it basically is the unregulation of emotions. So that's what it is. And I feel happiness that you will never experience. I experience this true sense of joy that only people with borderline personality can understand. And as a result, the highs are amazing and they're infectious and they're extraordinary. And when the business is going through a tough time, obviously it's tough and I have to integrate that into my day, going for a walk, managing it. But then when the highs come, I can spread this sense of excitement and joy throughout my colleagues and team members. So it has its positives as well.
But it's extraordinary what you're doing and what you have done, because so many people, particularly in a workplace environment, hide mm-hmm. mental illness issues and difficulties that they have. It's all about trying to conceal that. Whereas in your case, you're totally open about it.
Mm-hmm. I remember very early on when I was talking about Keep Happy, and it was my first time speaking publicly about it, someone came up to me, a very close advisor, and told me not to do it. They told me to stop, to think about it. Because a few years previously, I think it was Lion's Tea, but I'm not 100% sure on that, released a quote investigating mental health and found that 1 in 5 employers would go on record and not hire someone with a mental illness. So she turned around to me and said, if you go up there and speak, you are cutting yourself off from 20% of future job opportunities and more than likely another 30%. So I just sat there absolutely terrified that would this be this huge mistake? And you know what? In the past, it could have been. But the way the world is changing, the way society has opened up as a result of lockdown and COVID in the last 2 years particularly, I think we are moving forward. We're progressing into this new world of accepting that, you know, neurological conditions, mental illnesses, they're a part of life. It affects more people than we expect. You know, the World Health Organization says it's 1 in 4, but more likely it's more than that. And like, the reality is that there's so many of us affected.
Well, Amy Louise Carton of Keep Happy, well done and congratulations on all you've done and the best of luck with the business in
Thank
the future.
You very much.
Thanks for joining us on the programme.
Thank you.